For the past few years, it's been my privilege to be able to take a vacation in late July into early August to go off to Iowa to spend time with my in-laws, the Beckers. Arnold and Helga Becker are so kind and gracious to host us in their home and chiefly in their little cabin that they have on Clear Lake in Iowa. Typically, it's very, very oppressively hot. Ideal sauna-like climate for the growing of corn. And we have a time of refreshment there with our family. And for me, I've also used it as a time of reading biographies. Last year, I was able to come back and give you a synopsis of the biography of Henry Martin, who was the missionary to India. This year, I took with me not a single biography about a single individual, but I actually took along with me two biographical anthologies. One is entitled Heroes by Ian Murray. He speaks about such individuals as Jonathan Edwards, George Whitfield, John Newton, Charles Spurgeon, and various other lesser-known personalities. And this is a good read. But I found even the better read to be a book entitled War and Grace, Short Biographies from the World Wars. In fact, this is a book that I actually took with me 2 years ago to the cabin in Clear Lake. But as I began to read the first couple of chapters, the landlord there, Arnold Becker, who himself had fought in World War II, in fact, he fought actually in Hitler's army, he confiscated the book from me after the first couple of chapters, took it up to his bedroom, and I saw how interested he was in it, so I gifted the book to him. In fact, he liked it so much because his generation could so relate to it. This was about him and them that he bought multiple copies and has handed them out all throughout the Waterloo, Iowa area. So this little book has been a wonderful ambassador for the cause of the Lord Jesus Christ. And then it was about 2 months ago, a family from the church here actually gave me a gift, and when I opened it up, it was this book. And they said, "You ever hear that book before?" I says, "Yeah, I heard of it. In fact, you were there, Bertie, when I got the gift." I said, "I not only heard of it, but I began reading it, but it was confiscated from me, and now finally I get to finish what I had begun a couple of years earlier." And my desire is to take from this biographical anthology two interwoven biographies and bring them to you. I hope it'll be refreshing to you to realize that God worked not only in the biographies of people back during the time of the Reformation or during the time of the Puritan era or centuries past, but we see God working even in our century. And it's so interesting to see how the Lord profoundly used even the wickedness and the darkness and the horror and the brutality of World War II in particular. He used these things as forceps for the new birth, bringing many souls out of darkness into the light of Christ. World War II was a horrible time, but profoundly it was a wonderful time because many came to the Lord Jesus Christ during this time. In fact, my own father-in-law, Arnold, will say to me that it was a terrible time, but a wonderful time, spiritually speaking, in his own life. He would say his greatest regret in his life, as he's 83 years old now, is that he fought on the wrong side during World War II. But come along with me now, as I want to display to you the lives of two individuals highlighted here by Don Stevens in this book. Do you have handouts? If you don't have a handout, raise your hand. And I think that maybe Casey or Pete, you could get handouts to individuals. In the handout, I have simply an itinerary of our travels. First, you can see the individually want to speak about is a man named Mitsuo Fuchida. He was on the wrong side, we might say, as well, as he fought for the Japanese. And then the second individual we desire to speak about is Jacob DeShazer, who fought for the Allies, for the Americans. And you realize that this is a pair of biographies, the lives of which were caught up in the Pacific theater, not the European theater. World War II, oftentimes we think of D-Day, Normandy, Hitler, Berlin, the Russian front. But this is not that European theater. This is the Pacific theater. And you see the map here where we have Japan, we have Hawaii, which is Pearl Harbor, Midway Island. You've got San Francisco here, Alaska here, Australia here, China here. And these will be the geographical high points that we'll be considering. First, consider with me regarding Mitsuo Fuchida, Pearl Harbor. A Sunday in December of 1941 began as a normal day for the American Pacific Fleet, floating unsuspectingly in the peacetime harbor that was Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. Then, seemingly out of nowhere, without a declaration of war, the Japanese made a carrier launch air raid attack in the wee hours of the morning. And they just appeared. 360 torpedo planes, bombers, and fighters. They appeared. They swooped down. They brutalized the docked U.S. Pacific Fleet there in Pearl Harbor. And the man who led this assault on Pearl Harbor was a 39-year-old individual named Mitsuo Fuchida. He swooped down in his Katay bomber. He was, it said, first over the target, and he was last to leave the target. There's a movie called Tora, which describes the attack on Pearl Harbor. Really, it's toe, which means attack, and it was Fuchida who was the one who actually gave that order. Now, seeing the smoking hulks of the U.S. warships below him and the rat-like scurrying of the U.S. sailors, 3,000 of them died that day, this filled Fuchida with great pride. He later penned, "My heart was filled with joy at my success. It was the most thrilling exploit of my career." But little did he know that he, as the leader of the Japanese flying force, had aroused a sleeping giant, that's the United States of America, and that this sleeping giant, which had been aroused that morning by Fuchida's work, wouldn't rest until it made sure that Japan was paid back in full. Japan's unprovoked assault on Pearl Harbor pushed the U.S. into the war, both in the Pacific theater against Japan and in the European theater against Germany and Hitler. Now, on returning to Japan after the assault on Pearl Harbor, Fuchida was privileged to explain in detail the attack to Emperor Hirohito. And Hirohito was much impressed by the eloquence and the speaking prowess of Fuchida. And all of Japan idolized him, Fuchida, as a national hero. Though he was small in height, he apparently had a huge personality. And the media of Japan nicknamed him Hitler, as in 1941, he began to sport one of those toothbrush-type mustaches, as he highly esteemed Hitler and his forceful personality. So that's Pearl Harbor. Second main point on your outlines there, early days. Early days. Fuchida was born in 1902 into a rural family of five children. The name Mitsuo means third-born son. Pretty creative. His father was a teacher who noticed Mitsuo's natural leadership gifts. Mitsuo remembers how his school peers would seem to always choose him as their captain in their mock battles or in their hunting adventures during the winters. His patriotic father urged Fuchida into a military career, and this resulted in his entering the Naval Academy at age 19. And then he got the aviation bug, and he was driven to be Japan's top gun, flying their Zeros and their other airplanes. By 1941, he'd logged over 10,000 flight hours. He was married. He had two children, but he had become a heavy drinker, a heavy smoker. He embraced Shinto religion, which involved animism on the one hand, somewhat like Buddhism, and then also it involved ancestral worship of sorts. This was something that mixed in nicely with his attacking innocent civilians in the aggressive war that Japan had been involved with in China. I still remember as I spent time in China and roomed with my interpreter, and still with bitterness, he spoke about the way that the Japanese abused the Chinese during this era. This moves on then to thirdly, the battle for Midway Island. After Pearl Harbor, the Flying Ace raided a British base in Ceylon, and there he was involved in sinking a British carrier, aircraft carrier, called the Hermes. Fuchida also bombed the northern coast of Australia, and in the battle for Java, Fuchida's plane was hit and made to crash land in the Borneo jungles. Ray, you'd be interested to know that his radio operator died instantly. I say Ray because he was a navigator in a B-1 bomber for the U.S. But Fuchida himself crawled out of that wreck unscathed. And we're going to see how many times this man, who was seemingly slated for death, survived. It seemed that both he and Japan were unstoppable. Fuchida was the commander of the planes on four aircraft carriers who were slated to spearhead the battle at Midway. Now, Midway Island was a very strategic location. Whoever held Midway seemingly would be able to hold the Pacific. Now, just before this battle and this clash, Fuchida had an appendicitis attack, and he was very ashamed as he was in the sick bay of the aircraft carrier below the sea level line. And so we find that he disobeyed doctor's orders, crawled out of the aircraft carrier Akagi's sick bay, climbed onto the deck, where he resolved he would wave farewell to his pilots, whom he was supposed to be leading but wasn't able because of his appendicitis infirmity. Now, unknown to the Japanese at this time, the U.S. had cracked the Japanese code, and a squadron of U.S. bombers, right after the planes left the Akagi, the carrier, soon hammered the defenseless aircraft carrier. And because of the bombings on the carrier, if Fuchida himself had been below the sea level line in the sick bay, he would have either drowned or burned because the carrier absorbed a strike right at the sick bay. Instead, he was on the deck, and an explosion there hurled him 6 meters into the air, back onto the deck, breaking both of his legs. So he's got an appendicitis problem, and he's got broken leg problems. Two sailors recognized the crumpled Fuchida, put him on a net sling, and carried him to a lifeboat, where he was taken to a ship that narrowly escaped the U.S. sinking party. Now, Fuchida himself survived, again, slated for death, but Japan lost 4 aircraft carriers. And more importantly, they lost the crucial battle for Midway that really turned the tide in the Pacific into the Americans' favor. Really, at the loss of Midway, the writing was on the wall for Japan. Now again, Fuchida had narrowly escaped death. After Midway, he was assigned to the Naval War College in Tokyo, where he began to research on how Japan had been defeated at Midway. He drafted a final report, and that report was actually used later in 1950, where he co-authored a book entitled Midway, The Battle That Doomed Japan, and this revealed the sharp analytical mind that Fuchida had. Leads us to our fourth heading there, and that is Hiroshima. On August 5 of 1945, Fuchida attended a conference at Hiroshima. Now, the day before this was the day before the American B-29 bomber, anybody know the name of that bomber? That's right, the Enola Gay dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Now, unexpectedly, the day before that bombing, an order came telling Fuchida to report to another base. So Fuchida was providentially evacuated. I mean, here's a man who was a hell-bound sinner, slated for destruction. But God in his long-suffering providence was keeping him. Then in the days following the explosion, Fuchida returned to Hiroshima as one of the investigating team, and for 3 days they walked around the ruins with no protective outfits, just ordinary uniforms. I mean, who knew about the deadly radiation fallout? Almost all of the 70 men involved in that exploration died soon after from radiation. Yet Fuchida survived in perfect health. Now, in retrospect, it's hard to recognize, to fail to recognize, that a greater force was protecting this man. When the Americans forced Japan to sign a humiliating surrender aboard, who knows the battleship? The USS Missouri. Fuchida was there watching from an upper deck as he was a disillusioned captain whose aspirations had been sunk. He was the only surviving airman of the 7 commanders and 32 squadron leaders who'd bombed Pearl Harbor. Fifthly, then, post-war disillusionment. After the war, Fuchida began to drink heavily and to live recklessly. He became a farmer. And interestingly, while a farmer, the contemplative life, seeing things grow, began to cause him to think about God as the Creator. He even wrote a book, because he was a brilliant man. The book was entitled No More Pearl Harbor. He was haunted by the hopelessness of murderous human nature, which he had seen up close and personal in World War II. He spoke with certain Japanese prisoners who had returned from the U.S. here, who had told him how they had been treated well in U.S. prison camps, something totally contrary to what had taken place in Japanese prison camps. Several of the Japanese soldiers spoke of a woman named Peggy Koval, a young lady who visited and cared for Japanese prisoners in U.S. camps. When those Japanese prisoners asked her, "Why are you so kind to us?" she replied, "Because the Japanese killed my parents." You see, it seems that her parents had been missionaries, I believe, in China. And the Japanese had come to China. They accused her parents as being spies. And as a result, they actually beheaded her parents. But she always thought that if her parents had lived or had had the opportunity, they would have forgiven their executioners. And so her thought was that she would do what her parents otherwise would do, so she volunteered to assist Japanese POWs. Now, when Fuchida heard these stories, this was totally incomprehensible to his Shinto view of life. That leads us, sixthly, to converted to Christ. In 1948, Timothy Paish, who was a missionary in China, in the Tokyo area, Timothy Paish gave Fuchida a tract while they were standing at a Tokyo railway station. This tract was about an American prisoner of the Japanese called Jacob DeShazer, who had become a Christian and who had forgiven the cruelties he'd endured after reading the Bible and embracing Christ. As a result of having read this tract that he got from Paish about DeShazer, Fuchida bought a New Testament, and before he'd covered 30 pages, he was captivated. He said, "When I finally got to Luke 23 and I read of Christ on the cross saying, 'Forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing,' he saw how this mirrored the behavior of the woman Peggy Koval, about whom he had heard, and the man, Jacob DeShazer, about whom he had read." Fuchida later wrote, "I was impressed that I was one of those for whom Christ had prayed. I had slaughtered many men in the name of patriotism. Right there, I seemed to meet Jesus for the first time. I understood Jesus' death as a substitute for my wickedness and asked him to forgive my sin." That date was April 14, 1950. He says, "That is the day when I became a new person. My complete view of life was changed by the intervention of Christ." Fuchida was 47 years old at this time. Now, the Japanese media trumpeted this strange conversion. There was a headline that read, "Pearl Harbor Hero Converts to Christianity." His military comrades heard of this, and they thought he'd gone crazy. Conversions in Japan are very rare. We hear of Bangladesh and conversions, and we hear of conversions in Russia and conversions that take place even in Korea. But conversions in Japan are rare. There's really no indication of any revival really ever having taken place in Japan. Shintoism is darkness, and the lack of interpersonal dimensions to Japanese culture causes them to be a locked-up box in many ways. But this man was converted. As I say, his comrades thought he'd gone crazy. An ex-pilot with an artificial leg came to his house, and when invited in, he took an ornate knife, put it to the throat of Fuchida, and said, "I must kill you." For 3 hours, Fuchida told the man of the Bible's effect on him. The man put the knife down and left the place pondering the strange story. Number 7, kingdom work. 5 years later, the one-time kamikaze pilot, Mitsuo Fuchida, began to preach in a church in Amagasaki. His wife watched him very closely, wondering what effect this would have on his life. And to her surprise, there were certain sins in his life that began to fall away. He was a man who was a drunkard in some dimensions. He stopped drinking completely. He put away his use of tobacco. Eventually, he was baptized into the Osaka Presbyterian Church. His children, one by one, became Christians, something not seen very often in Japanese culture. In 1952, the Japanese government offered him an important position of Minister of Defense, but he refused it believing that his calling was to be a full-time evangelist. He began to crisscross the world, went to the U.S. quite often, speaking of Pearl Harbor and of the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, when Fuchida heard that this Jacob de Schazer, this is the man who had written that pamphlet that he had read, beginning in the Tokyo subway, he heard that Jacob de Schazer was in Japan. He wanted to meet him. You see, de Schazer had been a bombardier of the American revenge attack. We'll speak about this shortly. Doolittle's Raid. Anyone familiar with that? In 1942. This Doolittle raider shook hands then with the Pearl Harbor commander. And then visiting Pearl Harbor many times after this, Fuchida would say, he'd speak there frequently, "I'd give anything to retract my actions at Pearl Harbor, but it's impossible. Instead, I now work at striking the death blow to the basic hatred which infests the human heart. That hatred," Fuchida would say, "can't be uprooted without the assistance of the Lord Jesus Christ. He is the only one who is powerful enough to change lives and inspire new thoughts." At one point in 1955, Fuchida calculated that he'd preached at least 600 times to at least 200,000 people. But he never gave statistics about how many were converted because he was very suspicious about conversions and never really counted them as genuine until he saw people baptized and brought into the church. He spoke on until his death in May of 1976. He died at age 73, interestingly, with complications of diabetes. All the other bullets he dodged, God had kept him and prepared him that he would be an ambassador for the kingdom of God. So this is a striking experience of a Japanese man who was one whose feet were swift to shed blood, and his feet became beautiful, bringing the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. So that's the life of Mitsuo Fuchida. Any comments or questions you might have on that life? Jeff.
Presbyterian, was he a Presbyterian? Is that what he followed?
Yeah, eventually it seems that he followed along in that track, and just by the things that were written, it seems that he indeed had a Reformed perspective, theologically speaking. Rick.
It wasn't an obvious thing, an automatic thing for him to become guilt-ridden about his past, because even as late as the years I was in Japan, there were still people who were profoundly insulted by the fact that the homeland had been invaded by America. So he didn't join an overwhelming flood. He dispirited about their involvement.
And you can see why that one-legged warrior would take a knife to the throat of Fuchida that he had embraced in American religion. Anyone else? Any other thoughts in the comments? Well, let's go then to the life that was interwoven with Fuchida's life, and that is the life of a man named Jacob de Schazer. Not now talking about a Japanese warrior, we're talking about an American warrior. First, consider with me the early years. Jake de Schazer was born in 1912 into a devout Christian family in Salem, Oregon. His father died when he was 2 years old. His mother remarried. His stepfather, Hiram Andrus, was a fine man of a farmer. Jake, as a young man, went to the Free Methodist Sunday School, but religion really didn't make any dent on him. Christianity certainly did not. He would skip school. He would shoplift. He became very bored with life in the small Oregon town. When he was fully grown, he was 6 feet tall. He was sturdy in build. Since the small town offered only low pay and dead-end jobs, he signed up in the U.S. Air Force. It was peacetime, 1940, 2 years before Pearl Harbor. Jake trained as an aircraft mechanic and then as a bombardier. Ray, what in the world is a bombardier? Really loud. That's right. They didn't have all kinds of computer technology back then. They had to look through a scope, and they had to gauge the distance and the trajectory and the speed and try to drop it on the desired target. They would be there in the belly of the airplane, actually handling the explosives. So that's what he had trained for. But life was boring. At this time, combat seemed quite improbable. The U.S. wasn't engaged in the war. Jake became a reckless partier, but happiness eluded him. Second point, post Pearl Harbor. The unprovoked surprise attack of Japan at Pearl Harbor then catapulted the U.S. into the war. He was stationed really over here, way over in the U.S. I say that's San Francisco on the California coast. He was over in South Carolina in Columbia on an air base there. And at this time, we find that when the Americans heard of this, they were enraged with Japan's aggression. When the news of Pearl Harbor came on the air base in South Carolina, Jake himself was peeling potatoes in the mess hall. And when he heard of it, he began to take the potatoes and hurl them, smashing them up against the wall. And he was shouting, "The Japs are going to have to pay for this." Most Americans dreamed of revenge, but they didn't know how. The U.S. fleet in the Pacific had been crippled. The military hands were tied behind the Pentagon's backs. They didn't know how they could make a strike back. But the first response was to be entrusted to a 45-year-old lieutenant colonel named James Doolittle. Doolittle's Raiders. Doolittle was the Mutsuo Fuchida of the U.S. He was a superb pilot, an inspirational leader, a technical expert. So at Jake, South Carolina base, men were asked to volunteer to train for a dangerous mission. But they didn't know any specifics. Jake signed up. He was put on a flight crew. And for a month, they practiced there in South Carolina very short takeoffs and low-level flying. You could relate to this, Ray, because the B-1s were really low-level flyers. They didn't want to be detected by radar. Low-level flying in there, B-25B Mitchell bombers. Now, anybody know what a B-25B Mitchell bomber looks like? Was it a little, small, sleek fighter? Ray, you're saying no. What was a B-25 Mitchell like? You're giving away the story, Ray. That's right. There were these big, hulking bombers. You know, the multi-paneled windows on the front, and then you'd have the globe of windows on the top where the men would shoot, and on the bottom you'd have windows so people could see underneath. These were not sleek fighters. There in South Carolina, they would be told that they had to have the plane off the ground in 500 feet. So they'd rev the engine so hard. This was not the way you're supposed to take off on a B-25 Mitchell. They'd rev the engine so hard with the brakes on, and then they'd release, and they would try within 500 feet to get off the ground. At first, it was impossible, but eventually, they found a way, but they didn't know why. Nobody except the mission leader, L.T. Doolittle, had any idea of what the training was leading up to. Then an order came for them to fly across the U.S. from South Carolina to San Francisco. And upon arriving, the flight crews were amazed to see their B-25 Mitchells hoisted aboard and tied down in the flight deck of the aircraft carrier, the Hornet. And now they realized why their short takeoffs were so necessary. These massive bombers would have to take off in a shorter than a football field distance, or else. Or else what? Or else they would crash into the sea. Doolittle urged that any who had doubts should drop out and not sail. Many talked about it, but nobody quit. And as the Golden Gate Bridge faded in the east, as the Hornet began to head off to the west, the Chaser realized that the outlaw Japan would soon be receiving a payback. Now, the morale of the U.S. forces at this time was low. I needed a strike, a blow of some kind, and it was the Mitchells that were going to bomb Japan. Thirdly, leads us to Japan, here we come. The 80 airmen knew that even if they could get airborne from the Hornet's deck in land-based bombers, think about it. You may be able to take off from the deck, but how are you going to get back? Are you going to get back? Are you going to land on that little postage stamp airfield on top of an aircraft carrier? It's not going to happen. So they realized that they weren't going to be returning. And so we find that after bombing Japan, they learned that they must fly on until they would reach China. So the plan was that they would head toward Japan, and eventually they would depart, fly off, hit Japan, and instead of coming back, they would head off into China. Now, what's the problem with heading off into China? China was occupied basically by Japan. Now, there were a few pockets of Chinese who would be friendly to the U.S., and that was the hope that somehow they would land in friendly territory, but there were so many unknowns, so many question marks. Much of China was in Japanese hands. It was a high-risk operation. Could they find a friendly airfield to land in? Would they have to bail out when their fuel ran dry? And that was the whole issue. Even calculating, they wondered if they had enough fuel to actually get to China. In fact, well, if you watch the movie 30 Seconds Over Pearl Harbor, anybody ever watch that movie? It was created in the 1940s, 30 Seconds. It shows, it was very historical. In fact, there was footage, black and white footage, that was taken actually on the deck of the Hornet that was shown during the movie. And the movie showed how they would have these big canisters of fuel that, frankly, the bombardiers and others would have right alongside of them. And because the tanks really were nowhere near enough to get to Japan or anywhere else, they would pour into a funnel more fuel until eventually they had nothing. And again, you realize how full and how heavy the bellies of these planes were as they were trying to get off the deck at this time. It's really an extraordinary story. The danger was incalculable. April 5, 1942 was Easter Day. There was a solemn Christian service aboard the Hornet, but Jacob DeShazer was absent because he had no interest in religion or Christianity of any kind. Eventually on April 18 at 6:30 a.m., a Japanese naval vessel spotted the Hornet and its companion ships. This is much earlier than desired. They wanted to get the aircraft carrier closer so they'd have more fuel opportunity to get safe into Japan. But now they had to take off early. So we find that though they desired to leave later, they were forced to launch. The fuel equation had become even more dire. The Hornet then turned into a 27-knot headwind at full speed. Why did they get into a headwind at full speed? That's right, needed more lift because all they had was a football field length to take off on. And all 16 Mitchell bombers took off safely. In fact, the plan was that if any of the bombers' engines had problems, they would hoist it and dump it into the sea. No time for repairs. All 16 took off safely. The Oscar-winning 30 Seconds Over Tokyo movie showed actual footage of these takeoffs. On each side of DeShazer's plane nose was painted, most of them had some kind of a decal or statement on it. On his it said, "A bat out of hell." In many ways it was true regarding DeShazer's heart condition. DeShazer's bat was assigned to bomb Nagoya, which was about 300 miles south of Tokyo. The flight there seemed endless, but upon arriving, DeShazer made sure that the bombs were dropped exactly as planned. Fourthly now, looking to land in China. They hit their targets, and then they turned westward. And as darkness fell, they flew on to China. And 15 minutes before midnight, DeShazer's Mitchell ran out of fuel. And at 3,000 feet, somewhere over China, the pilot shouted, "We gotta jump!" And DeShazer floated down and landed in a Chinese cemetery, fracturing some ribs as he hit the ground. Now, the physical damage that Doolittle's raiders accomplished was minimum, but there was a great boost that was given to the American morale. The Japanese leaders were enraged, and because of this, they were unwisely lured into the battle at Midway, which, as we've already heard, was won by the U.S. and its allies, signaling the doom of Japan. But none of this helped the DeShazer on that April night as he walked for hours with his broken ribs. Eventually, he was taken prisoner by Japanese soldiers. Lead us number five to abused POWs. There were eight men who survived. Of Doolittle's raiders, eight men actually survived. There were some others who landed along the coast. Some others actually got away and were in the hands of friendly Chinese and made it back. But there were eight men who survived as POWs. They were rounded up and sent to Tokyo for questioning. DeShazer was one of these. Japan's offended pride was enraged against them. They were taken to a prison camp at Kempeitai. And at this camp, they had refined the tools of extracting confessions, bringing great agony upon the prisoners, bringing them to the brink of death. The eight men were held in solitary confinement for 46 days in Tokyo. They were beaten, kicked, starved, denied sleep, not permitted to wash, shave, or remove their uniforms. The wrath of the Japanese nation focused on them. Eventually, DeShazer found that they had charts and they had maps. Like, they knew what the strategy was with the raid already, as they had gone to some of the wrecked Mitchells, but they continued to punish and interrogate the men. The prisoners were eventually transferred to Shanghai, China. Lice and rats in that prison camp were everywhere. DeShazer's cell was 9 feet long and 5 feet wide. Dysentery set in. There was a show trial. Three of the eight men were shot, October 15, 1942. Five other survivors. Eventually, a Lieutenant Robert Meter, who was a co-pilot on the sixth plane, died of malnutrition and beriberi. He was 26 years old. That left four survivors. These four survivors, who were terribly disillusioned and disheartened, were shown the wasted body of Meter as it lay in the coffin. It depressed them, made them hopeless. DeShazer was struggling to stay sane while fighting loneliness and uncertainty. As he later wrote, it was coupled with the hatred for the Japanese people that nearly drove him crazy. Number six, an unexpected improvement. Remember I told you about that movie, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo? One of the surviving pilots had gotten back to the U.S. A book had been written, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. Hollywood got a hold of the book, quickly made the movie to encourage the morale in America. And so this movie and this book were dedicated to the 8 survivors of Doolittle's raid. 4 were already dead. Tokyo heard of this. Tokyo realized that the loss of Midway, the war was going against them, and they realized that eventually the condition of these prisoners would be something they'd have to answer for. Fearing retribution, they began to somewhat improve the conditions. A few books were then given to the 4 surviving prisoners. Food became a little bit better. Among these books was a Bible. You see, they had looted some missionaries in China, and they had brought the books to these men. This is number 7, a spiritual transformation. None of the 4 men was religious, but each, of course, wanting something to read, they were going crazy in their idleness. Each read the Bible, and for each man, it provided a message that linked them back to sanity. Bob Height, the co-pilot, wrote, "It was the first time any of us had really read the Bible from cover to cover." Height began to feel sorrow instead of hatred for the Japanese guards. One day, DeShazer himself was cleaning his cell when a guard looked in and yelled at him, "Hayaku," which means hurry up. DeShazer was festering with rage. He yelled back, "Go jump in the lake." Maybe there were some other things he said too. Later he recorded, before he knew what was going on, the door was unlocked. The guard hit him in the head with his fist, immediately kicked him in the stomach, and he kicked him, the guard, back in the stomach with the bare foot, and he hit me with his steel scabbard. He said he took a bucket of water that he had and threw it onto the guard. Seemingly that cooled him down. This indicates the kind of intense rage DeShazer had toward his captors. In May of 1944, it was DeShazer's turn to read the Bible. The guard told him he could have it for 3 weeks, and it proved to be quite an experience for him. The only light in the solitary cell came through the vent at the top of one wall, but it was enough. Remember that leaflet I told you that DeShazer had written explaining his conversion experience? The leaflet was called "I Was a Prisoner of Japan." Again, it was published in Japanese for the Japanese. Here's the account of what happened. DeShazer says this in his pamphlet: "I eager began to read the Bible's pages. Chapter after chapter gripped my heart." You see, this is why Fuchida was so interested in reading this book. "In due time, I came to the books of the prophets and found that their every writing seemed to focus on a divine redeemer from sin, one who was to be sent from heaven to be born in the form of a human babe. Their writings so fascinated me that I read them again and again until I had earnestly studied them through 6 times. I went on to the New Testament and there read of the birth of Jesus Christ, the one who actually fulfilled the very prophecies of Isaiah. On June 8, 1944, the words of Romans 10:9 stood out boldly before my eyes. If thou shalt confess with thy mouth Jesus is Lord, and shalt believe in your heart that God raised from the dead, you shall be saved. In that very moment, God gave me grace to confess my sins to him. He forgave me, and he saved me for Jesus' sake." He was saved at this time through the reading of the Bible. What a terrible thing! World War II, the brutality, the POW abuse. But you see what God was doing? I mean, a man like DeShazer, who was a reckless partier of a guy, how are you ever going to settle somebody down to focus on the Word of God? Providentially, the Lord put him in such circumstances. Number 8, spiritual fruit. DeShazer's new faith was soon tested. He speaks about going to a cell to clean a toilet, he was escorted by a guard who was in a hurry. The guard slapped him and kicked him and abused him. But the very next day, when DeShazer saw that guard, his fleshly reaction was to take his fist to him. But again, as a Christian man, remembering what the Bible said, he called out, "Ahayu gozama'u," which means good morning. The guard gave him a strange look, and every morning DeShazer tried to bring some kind of friendly greeting. One day the guard spoke to him through the door. They talked to each other. They became friendly. On one occasion, he opened the little observation door and handed DeShazer a boiled sweet potato. Another time, DeShazer received 5 figs. DeShazer wrote, "I knew then that God had done a work in my heart, no matter what the circumstances were." But DeShazer was in poor physical condition. He'd been 26 months in solitary confinement. It's taken a toll on him and the other 3 surviving raiders. Every night they could still hear torture and screams from other captives. One time his body became enveloped with boils in boredom. He chose to count them. He counted up to 75 and he stopped counting. All 4 surviving raiders were nearing death. But then someone came and actually gave him a vitamin shot, an injection. And he sensed something was going on. He began to pray for peace. And the very day he began to pray for peace, it was the final nuclear bomb that hit Nagasaki. And as a result, unconditional surrender followed. I heard about the peace, and now we come to number 9, freedom at last. Finally, August 20, 1945, the cell doors were opened, and DeShazer and the other 3 surviving raiders were free, free from months of suffering. He returned back at home to America. At Salem, Oregon, his mother had been praying. They'd heard that no one knew about the 8 Doolittle raiders who were unaccounted for. Eventually, they heard 4 survived. Mom didn't know which of the 4. Eventually, he returned back home. Ahead of DeShazer lay a homecoming, a time in the hospital, time of recovery. Now, number 10, a missionary to Japan. DeShazer had committed himself to be a Free Methodist missionary. After some time of recuperation, he enrolled at Seattle Pacific College to prepare himself for missionary work in Japan. It was at this college in 1946 that he met and married his wife, Florence, who proved to be an ideal support to him. Together they sailed for Japan in 1948, just as 6 years and 8 months after he had set out to fly to Japan with a very different purpose. They eventually had 5 children, and some of them were actually born in Japan. DeShazer then wrote a very simplified account of the Doolittle Raid, what happened to the 8 men who fell into Japanese hands, and how they'd been transformed by the message of the Bible. Many millions of copies in leaflet form were printed in Japanese and were widely distributed in the immediate post-war years. It was an impressive story. And again, it was a copy of this leaflet that was given to the 47-year-old Mutsuo Fuchida at that station in Tokyo in 1950. The DeShazers gave 30 years of their lives to Japan. They were even responsible for planting a church in Nagoya, the very place that Jake had let go of his bombs on to hit some certain industrial sites there in Nagoya during Doolittle's raid. One high spot in his ministry came when Captain Keto became a Christian. He was the guard who had given the prisoners the Bible in their Nanking prison. So isn't it striking how God works in mysterious ways? You know, it was said of Samson's carcass, Out of the eater, something to eat. Out of the eater, something sweet. A stinking carcass. Bread, honey. And the stinking carcass of World War II brought about the salvation of countless, many souls. And this book is filled with such accounts, which only scratch the surface of what God is able to do in the darkest of circumstances. Well, I hope in some way this encourages you to ponder the handiwork of God in our, well, it was the 20th century, the century gone by, and realize that the Lord is also with us, even in dark days during the 21st century. Would you please close for us, Ray, with a word of prayer?